Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our first function here at 47 Phillip Street in the year of 2020, and our guest speaker who's been here before is Nicholas Hasluck. Now, Nicholas is here on the occasion of the publication of his memoir, Beyond the Equator, an Australian memoir, and before giving the topic of the talk tonight, I'll briefly speak about our speaker and author. Nicholas Hasluck studied law in Western Australia, then at Oxford, before practising law in Perth and becoming a Supreme Court judge. He's been twice shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Prize, and he's written 15 works of fiction, one of which was the Age Book of the Year Award. And according to a reviewer in the Weekend Australian, as a judge and accomplished novelist, he's only one of two living Australians with such an achievement, and the other would be the former High Court Judge Ian Callanan. Right. So it's great to have Nicholas back at the Sydney Institute. We're great to have him over from Perth. And the topic for the night is the Kangaroo Valley Set, Australians in Britain in the 1960s. Nicholas Hasluck, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much for those words, Gerard, and it's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming out on a night like this to talk about times past. Well, as Gerard has indicated, and as your programme shows, I'm really going to talk tonight about my recently published memoir, Beyond the Equator, which looks at Australians abroad in the 1960s. Now, as the immodest author of a book about myself, I should probably begin with some cautionary words coined by the Hollywood movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn, famed for the mangled wisdom that left his lips occasionally. I don't think anyone should write his autobiography until after he's dead. So there it is. When Sam Goldwyn thought aloud, it sounded funny, but was often wise. Include me out, he once said. What better way to describe one's private feelings about some half-baked scheme that is widely applauded but sure to fail? As in the peculiar postmodern world of academics and activists, human rights for rivers and trees. Yes, of course, spot on, include me out. It's a wise old way of saving face while saving money. That place is always so crowded, no one goes there anymore. Goldwyn again, with some words that bring me back to my topic. Talk about well-known haunts in London, Earl's Court or Kangaroo Valley may have the unwanted side effect of prompting people to think of a city still popular, but not the draw card it once was. Barry Humphries, Germaine Greer, Clive James, and so on. These are the luminaries who left Oz before me to see what the wider world could offer. They made their mark. We know their stories. Is there anything more to be said about London in the 60s? I believe there is, although an echo of Clive James probably may be heard in my account of my arrival in London in August 1964. Is what I say worthwhile? Is the tone closer to farce than to history? Let me quote. My postgraduate friends from the good ship Himalaya had taken off to confer with their supervisors in Oxford or to explore various corners of Scotland and Wales. But some of those who had come to England on working permits were still around. Jeff Lee and Bob Illich, for example. They were staying at the Overseas Visitors Club near Earl's Court while looking for a flat. I called in to see how they were getting on and finished up in the basement bar of their club, listening to a Jamaican rock band called Jimmy and the Vagabonds. The blokes around us in the bar were brimful of their not quite believable exploits on the continent. Someone had picked up a swag of Steins at the Munich Beer Festival for resale in Earl's Court. Some adventurous soul had been running with the bulls in Pamplona. There was a Sydney sider who had left London some time ago to train as a matador. He was now a draw card in the bull rings of Andalusia under the name El Australiano. Catching up with Jeff and Bob often led onto a party in a flat or bedsit with a bunch of Aussie or Kiwi hearts who formed part of the network in Kangaroo Valley. Pommy hearts were sought after but seldom seen, hence the plaintive drinking song at that time, and I quote, "I wouldn't say no to a nice cold beer, and I wouldn't say no to a naughty. The beer over here isn't fit to drink, and the girls are high and haughty." The absence of Pommy hearts didn't seem to worry Jeff, a laconic storyteller. On the voyage across, he had bought some supposedly precious sapphires in the back streets of Colombo. At Tilbury, he smuggled the gems ashore in his underpants, but soon found out their true value. Nil. They were bits of cut glass. Worth nothing. But not to worry, here he was, only a few weeks later, in the heart of Kangaroo Valley, surrounded by a bunch of good-humoured Aussie girls admiring a handful of his very precious sapphires. Worth a fortune in the Far East. Now, in the midst of all this, as I explored various quarters of the city and became adept at riding trains on the underground and so on, I gradually got to grips with the political situation. Britain was having to reconfigure its role as a former imperial power and deal with consequential issues such as immigration and the status of its former colonies, especially Rhodesia. The Tories under Prime Minister Macmillan had sought admission to the European economic community, but had been rebuffed. The John Profumo-Christine Keeler scandal had led to Macmillan's resignation. In October 1964, soon after my arrival, his successor, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, was ousted at a general election by the Labour Party's Harold Wilson. Britain's wartime Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, died shortly after the election. I stood in the Strand to watch the funeral procession on its way to the City of London and to all of those assembled in St Paul's Cathedral. The Australian Prime Minister, Sir Robert Menzies, was one of the 12 pallbearers. The coffin was placed in a gun carriage after the service and conveyed to a pier nearby. The waterborne procession up the Thames left a lasting impression when ships' cranes were dipped to honour the wartime Prime Minister. He was to be buried in the Bladen churchyard near his birthplace at Blenheim Palace, the home of his famous forebear, the Duke of Marlborough. In the meantime, Menzies had gone down to the crypt of the cathedral to give a talk about Churchill, for the two leaders had worked closely in the early years of the war. They shared other links. They had both been forced out of office of Prime Minister in their respective countries, but had come back. Both were honorary benches of Gray's Inn. In the course of his address to the BBC audience throughout Britain, Menzies said this of Churchill, and I quote, "In the whole of recorded modern history, his was, I believe, the one occasion when one man with one soaring imagination, with one fire burning in him, and with one unrivaled capacity for conveying it to others, won a crucial victory, not only for the forces, but for the very spirit of human freedom." Unquote. It struck me as significant, and as evidence of the continuing links between Britain and Australia, that Menzies was invited to play such a central role in the proceedings. I had by now, as a law student, been to Gray's Inn myself and visited the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand. I had seen some of the leading judges in action, including Lord Denning, author of the Denning Report on the Profumo Affair. And there it is, if you happen to be interested. I bought that online some years ago. Now, my legal, and of course the site of these legal institutions, the courts and the famous judges, were a reminder to one such as myself of the strong links between Britain and Australia embedded in the common law, from Magna Carta to parliamentary rule and judicial independence. However, I left London and made my way to Wadham College, Oxford, to commence some legal studies. My legal studies began to occupy most of my time, but I was determined to keep in touch with broader concerns by attending debates in the Oxford Union. Debates at the Union usually included two or three visiting speakers, often politicians of the first rank. I have a vivid recollection of the evening when Lord Hailsham spoke. He had been one of the contenders for leadership of the Conservative Party, you may recall, in the aftermath of Macmillan's resignation. The prevailing mood of the undergraduate audience at the Union was always left of centre, and therefore to have a leading Tory spokesman in their midst was a chance to become especially vociferous. To everyone's surprise, however, Hailsham treated those present to the most astonishing feat of oratory I have ever witnessed. At the beginning of his speech, the audience was totally against him, and with catcalls and interjections, constantly abusive. But he won them over. He had presence, he had wit, he was cogent. Above all, he was passionate. Freedom can only be won at the expense of tyranny, he declared, by concern for the common good. At the end of it all, the students rose to their feet in a standing ovation, and when the vote was taken, his team had won. It is the only time in my life that I have seen an entire audience persuaded from one point of view to another on a political subject in the space of 20 minutes or so. I doubt that I will see it happen again. That too was a characteristic of the Oxford Union at that time, and perhaps of Oxford generally, open-mindedness. Another striking debate took place towards the end of my first term when Malcolm X, the American civil rights extremist, joined a group of speakers at the Union. Malcolm X was a leading figure in the so-called Nation of Islam, a political maverick who had made a tempestuous journey from backstreet hustler in New York to radical preacher. He had come to speak in favour of the motion that extremism in defence of liberty is no vice, moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. In the course of the debate, the dark-suited, heavily bespectacled Malcolm X, the first of three speakers on the affirmative side, was quick to apply the motion to forces wrapped in the red, white, and blue colours of the American flag, a tattered relic of imperialism, he claimed, which kept black people from their kin on the African continent and should be torn to pieces. Quote, when Americans bomb villages in the African Congo, he rapped out, this is undoubtedly extremism, but it is never referred to as such, because it is financed by America and endorsed by the West, unquote. Malcolm X, the Islam activist, was assassinated in early 1965, some 2 months after I saw him tearing stars and stripes off the trio opposing him in the Oxford Union. So in that way, too, the Oxford Union was a source of relevant events in the political scene. The most controversial president of the Union was undoubtedly Tariq Ali, a leading figure on the far left of politics both then and for many years to come. He presided over a much publicised debate on the topic that this House would not fight for king and country. You'll be aware we still see Tariq Ali on our TV sets even today. He's still a commentator. Now, an opportunity arose for me to contrast the somewhat cavalier proceedings in the Oxford Union with proceedings in the House of Commons when I was persuaded by my housemate to join him on a trip to Westminster. This was hosted by his local member, a Labour backbencher from West Hartlepool called Ted Leadbitter. While we were walking on the terrace overlooking the Thames, we were introduced to one of the luminaries of the Wilson government, Richard Crossman, formerly an Oxford Don. By this time, the Conservative Party was led by Ted Heath, with Ian MacLeod as Shadow Chancellor. I quote from my book, quote, "When we sat down for afternoon tea, the room around us suddenly began to empty out because MacLeod was about to speak. 'We have to watch this,' Leadbitter exclaimed. He jumped up and within a few minutes had found a place for us in the public gallery. MacLeod was one of the few speakers who could fill the parliamentary chamber, we were told, and he did so on this occasion with a searing attack on the government. He praised the late President Kennedy for being an idealist without illusions, and derided Prime Minister Wilson as being simply an illusionist without ideals." An aphorism that has now become an oft-quoted political quip. A potential leader of the Tories, MacLeod died soon afterwards, his promise unfulfilled. End quote. I digress briefly to say that in the course of the Brexit imbroglio in recent times, we have seen some rowdy debates in the House of Commons on TV. These scenes with John Bercow as Speaker immediately took me back to my undergraduate debating days in the Oxford Union, and sometimes even to the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, a scene concocted by an Oxford Don. When Boris Johnson became Prime Minister, some commentators seemed to think that he would be overwhelmed by his opponents in the House. This I doubted. As a former president of the Oxford Union, with a fine mop of hair in need of a hat, Boris seemed perfectly equipped for the shouting matches and shenanigans in the House by view of his Oxford Union experience. Now, at Oxford in the mid-60s, politics was not the only area of controversy. I quote from the book, "One evening I found my way to a crowded hall near the Oxford Union. I took a seat as the chairman of the meeting introduced the two speakers who were to press the respective claims of the candidates for the coveted Oxford Chair of Poetry. There was the modernistic American poet Robert Lowell and the elderly English bard Edmund Blunden, who had made his name in the aftermath of the Great War. The audience was told that the champion for each of the poets, the two contenders not being present in person, would read from the works of their preferred candidate. The chairman rang a little bell. The contest had begun. John Wayne, a poet himself, went to the rostrum first and began to read from Lowell's recently published collection, For the Union Dead. The graphic contemporary images were laid before us. A savage civility slides by on Greece, Hiroshima boiling. When the long-haired, dishevelled poet at the rostrum finished, the audience applauded rapturously, as I did. We were fiercely partisan. Robert Lowell was the confessional voice of the here and now. Blunden's so-called champion was an academic from a college nearby. Pale, prissy, bespeckled, he was given to introducing poems about pikes and glades and meadows with over-elaborate explanations. These unwanted footnotes were accompanied by nervous coughing fits and the flutter of a lily-white hand. Here was a remote and ineffectual Don incarnate. It was intolerable. He of the lisping voice and the pallid brow was pathetic. His presence an absurdity, an embarrassment, an insult. There were mutterings. The chairman rang his little bell and called for order, but to no avail. Blunden's popinjay sidled away from the rostrum to a background noise very close to jeering. We waited smugly for the vote to be taken. Everyone present seemed to be of one mind. Our man, Robert Lowell, had won. But what was this? John Wayne had wrested the book of Blunden's verse from the popinjay's grasp and was back at the microphone demanding a second go. The chairman's little bell tinkled in vain. The impromptu speech came at us in a rush, but the message was clear. Wayne was indignant, angry, upset. He was for Lowell, but he admired Blunden too. What we had just heard wasn't Blunden, not Wayne's Blunden, a poet of the Great War who had lived long enough to tell the truth about the Western Front. What about hearing some more? And he began to read from Blunden's poem Never Such Love in the strong, fervent voice of one who has savoured the lines for years. Better in love to seal the love's sure lips, for truly love was before words were, and no word given, no word broken. As it was on the night I saw Lord Hailsham in action, this was a moment of reversal. Swept to its feet by a passion equal to the poet's final stanza, the audience rewarded Wayne with a standing ovation and thereby honoured Blunden in absentia. The whole notion of casting votes for poets suddenly seemed ridiculous. Blunden won the official contest with a handsome majority. Some days later, by an unlikely but pleasing quirk of fate, I had the opportunity to congratulate him in person. I'd managed to get a ticket to the first night of a production of Christopher Marlowe's masterpiece, Dr. Faustus. When interval came, I saw Blunden in the foyer, an elderly, white-haired fellow standing meekly by himself. He seemed to be fumbling with something, and a moment later he accidentally dropped some tiny capsules on the floor. I came to his aid. In the confusion of the moment, I missed my opportunity and failed to congratulate him. I've always regretted this failure because the student newspapers had probably left him with an impression that the younger generation was all for Lowell, and news of John Wayne's extraordinary intervention may not have reached him. There were many other notables in the foyer that night, for this was a stellar occasion. Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were then at the height of their fame as a consequence of their well-publicised affair while making the film Cleopatra a few years earlier. Richard Burton's former tutor at Merton College, Neville Coghill, had finally prevailed upon his former pupil to come back to Oxford for a season featuring Coghill's production of Dr. Faustus with Elizabeth Taylor as Helen of Troy. In Christopher Marlowe's words, the face that launched 1,000 ships and burnt the topless towers of Ilium. I found the play enjoyable, but in the end the critics weren't as kind. Elizabeth Taylor was admittedly very beautiful. She moved quietly about the stage as a kind of apparition. But I was surprised to find that Richard Burton was shorter and stockier than I imagined, and somewhat overweight. His physical appearance was redeemed, of course, by the resonance of his magnificent voice. Close to 20 years later, in a very unusual setting, I was called upon to recapture my evening with Helen of Troy. I joined a small group of Australian writers who travelled to China at the invitation of the Chinese Writers Association. This was shortly after the downfall of the infamous Gang of Four, and the mood around us was very strange. After a banquet at the Beijing Duck Restaurant, we were told that we were privileged to have been invited to the apartment of a distinguished editor, Professor Yang Zani. When we reached the cars outside the restaurant, there was a good deal of milling about. In the end, as leader of the Australian party, I found myself sitting in the back seat of a car beside a man I understood to be Professor Yang Zani, but without an interpreter to assist me. We smiled at each other enigmatically for several minutes. He then cut short my opening gambit, made in stilted pigeon, I'm ashamed to say, by inquiring in impeccable English, "Hasluck, I believe you were at Oxford in the mid-60s. I agreed that I was. What did you think of the Neville Coghill production of Dr. Faustus starring Taylor and Burton, he asked. The two stars seem shorter and fatter than expected, I replied. He chuckled at this. It turned out that my Chinese companion had been at Oxford in the 1930s. While studying under Burton's tutor, Neville Coghill, he had met his English-born wife, Gladys Young. They then returned to China. In the Cultural Revolution, they were sent to a remote corner of China, tainted by their time at Oxford, perceived as intellectuals corrupted by their learning. To meet them, after all of this, was a poignant reminder that links to Oxford exist throughout the world. But that wasn't the end of the story. Some years later, in June 1989, within a few days of Chinese tanks entering Tiananmen Square to crush the emerging democracy movement, I heard the voice of Yang Zani on the BBC World Service. With extraordinary bravery, the elderly editor denounced the Chinese leadership as bloodthirsty criminals. He and his wife were immediately condemned to further exile. They are not forgotten by those who knew them. There are many other stories in my book, Travels in Europe, a romance that enriched my time at Oxford, visits to the Vatican and various royal sites, an account of working for the Police Review in Fleet Street, the journal of the British Bobby, after I completed my degree. So much to say, but time is against me, and thus, in closing, I feel obliged to return briefly to the question I posed earlier, whether a memoir of this kind can add anything worthwhile to our understanding of times past or of times to come. Probably not, because human memory is fallible, and in any event, this is not a carefully documented work of history. Nonetheless, within the jumble of public and private events, an attentive reader may well perceive some themes, or interesting ironies at least, that bear upon memorable issues both then and now. Rebuffed in the early 1960s, Britain joined the European community eventually. It will now withdraw, but for better or for worse. What exactly did Macmillan's Winds of Change speech achieve in Rhodesia? What has been the overall effect of widespread immigration? What can we learn from the building of the Berlin Wall and the fermenting of the Cultural Revolution in China? Did the rhetoric of Malcolm X and others like him set the scene for the terrorism of today? Questions of this size can't be answered easily, but they may bring with them a look at smaller and more personal issues. According to some historians, the motivation underlying significant events is often referable not to policy or purpose, but to self-interest or quirks of personality, moments of the kind reflected in diary entries and occasional memoirs. In these postmodern times, when so many Australian academics query the value of Western civilization, using identity politics and the weasel word inclusion to fashion orthodoxies incompatible with freedom of speech and the rule of law, what is one to make of the open-mindedness that was once a feature of debates in the Oxford Union? Will political correctness become so pervasive that as to some feverish new campaign, human rights for rivers and trees perhaps, we overlook our freedom to say, include me out? During the Cultural Revolution, my Chinese friends, Yang Zani and Gladys Young, were tainted by their time at Oxford and sent away, as if what they learnt in Britain, their exposure to the best that has been thought and said throughout the ages, from Christopher Marlowe to Winston Churchill, might seriously weaken the Orwellian mindset of those in power. Perhaps it would. It appears from the stand taken by the Youngs after Tiananmen Square that their experience of the wider world had broadened their outlook and strengthened their capacity to speak truly. My memoir, Beyond the Equator, may not amount to history, but it gives glimpses here and there of what was happening in another era, And what could happen again if people fail to protect their freedoms or lose their concern for the common good? I will close with a passage from the book in which I touch on some of the themes mentioned in this talk. And I quote that passage. Like many of my companions on the Himalaya, I carry in me traces of what happened in the past that point to what the world has now become. And so my Oxford days are over but not gone. The ancient university lives on in the imagination of those who have been there. Year after year, students of one kind or another, who have been lucky enough to spend a portion of their youth in that fanciful place, have been enriched by its unusual ways. They have left behind in their turn a touch of vitality and a little of their personal aspirations, so that the city of dreaming spires is not like a city revered because it embodies the past, but revered because it has kept alive a youthful and ever-present spirit of adventure. Thank you for your attention.
Many thanks, Nicholas. So Nicholas Haslach's book, Beyond the Equator, an Australian memoir, we've got for sale tonight, and I'm sure our speaker would be happy to sign a copy of his enlightening memoir. Now, if you come back here, I'll lead off, and then we'll take questions from the floor. Let me. You spoke early on about hearing Lord Hailsham and the impact he had, but as someone whose father was a prominent member of the Fraser Coalition government, and as someone who was obviously interested in the conservative side of politics, how do you reflect on the time in Britain when you were there around the time of Churchill's death until the period of the Margaret Thatcher ascendancy, where you seem to have a lot of very weak Conservative Tory party leaders, Harold Macmillan, Alexander Douglas Hume, Ted Heath. How did you feel that, what do you feel was the reason for that decline in the period from the early 60s, which you would have witnessed, and you saw some of the lead figures there a bit beyond into the time you were there? How did you see all that around the time of the Profumo affair, which oddly enough brought down a government or a prime minister?
Yes. Small point of correction, Gerard, of course, my father was in the Menzies era. You said Fraser. That's just a very small point.
Oh, it's quite a big point.
But well, coming back to your point, of course, as I look back in this book and reflect on some of the things described in it, I suppose one of the things that strike me is how strikes me as how naive someone about my age, a rather uncritical traveller, just taking things as they were, one sort of presumed that the relationship between Australia and England would run on in much the same way. But I try and draw out in the book in a way it was in a stage of complete transformation. And I think there were various factors at work. I think, in a sense, scandals such as the Profumo affair, that was soon followed by Jeremy Thorpe's being embroiled in scandal of equal magnitude. I think that all led to a certain upsetting of the framework of stability of debate, both in the House of Commons and in the wider sphere. So I think that was one fact that was taking place. And then, of course, I'm not an economist by training, don't pretend to be, but I mean also all the factors at work of the negotiation to enter Europe. And, of course, there was the devaluation of the pound and all those other economic events that were taking place. So I think that general feeling of things being shaken up and unsettled was the thing that led to quite a profound transformation of the scene generally.
Thank you. Michael?
The inference in your talk is that going to Britain in those days was a rite of passage, intellectually to Oxford, but also people escaping, if you like, what was regarded as a closed society in Australia to the great, wonderful going home, I think was the expression used, to Britain. In view of Brexit, do you expect a return to the quotes, good old days. And could I say in passing that I discuss this issue in the coming issue of the Spectator magazine.
Right. Well, I don't think I foresee a return to the good old days, but at the same time, I mean, as we all know, in this immediate aftermath of the whole Brexit situation, Britain is obviously, both at an intellectual level and at an economic level, really having to rethink its entire position. And although I don't see a return to what was there before, I did touch on, in the talk I give as I do in the book, that the links between Britain and Australia and many of the other Commonwealth countries in the legal sphere, which is my own sphere, of course, are really quite deep and quite profound. And as we all know, the whole debate about Brexit is very tangled and there are all sorts of threads woven through it. But one would gather one element in it was a certain sense of the abdication of Britain's responsibility for its judicial processes and its parliamentary process and so on. And we don't know what the final negotiations will produce, but one understands there will be a return to a British sovereignty of a kind which had been, undermined to some extent by the years in the Union. So I think some of those factors and the kind of redefining of relationships, and Australia has to do likewise, but not perhaps under such immediate pressure, may well lead to a consolidation and a kind of forward dynamism, which wouldn't repeat the old days, but might signal a new order. It's just a theory, a surmise.
Yourself aside, how much?
You gotta speak up.
Yourself aside, how much does the caricature of Barry McKenzie reflect the conduct of some of the Australians in Earl's Court at the time?
So it's a question on to what extent Barry McKenzie reflected the culture of Australians in Earl's Court.
Well, I think the answer is, and I don't know whether to say regrettably or not, but fairly considerably. I mean, I have a few other stories, and there was not enough time tonight to go into them, but, the mood in Earl's Court was very much something that Barry Humphreys evoked so skillfully and so well, and all satire, of course, is an exaggeration, so there are certainly strong elements of exaggeration, but as Gerard was saying a moment ago, the voyage to London and all that went with it was a rite of passage, and people were sort of, in one sense, breaking free, but in the other sense, just echoing some of the tribal instincts they had brought with them. And even when I was travelling around in Europe, which I record in the book, in places like the Hofra House in Munich and so forth, Australians were all over the place doing Baz and McKenzie type of things. Barry Humphreys is, of course, a satirist, and therefore things are necessarily embellished and exaggerated. But I think there's a strong element of truth in much of it.
Will Chundering come back?
Well, that's putting it in a nutshell. Yeah,
Nicholas,
Just
speak
up.
The people that did what you did found their passage, whatever. Some of our most notable Australians stayed. Was there ever a temptation on your part not to come home, and if there wasn't, tell us about it.
After I got married in England, and after I completed my degree, I worked in London in Fleet Street on a magazine for a time and so forth. So there was a sense of toying with other options, but I think for myself I realised that in a sense, at the core, I was a lawyer, and the Australian legal profession was where I'd been brought up. My parents, of course, were keen for me to return, so ultimately there was not a real moment of dilemma. But in other words, I didn't have quite the determination that the Greers and Jameses and Robert Hughes and all those other luminaries I mentioned had to stay, because they were in the arts, and I think they perceived that thing which I had some interest, of course, in literature, as you know, you've heard, but I also had the strong focus of the legal profession behind me, whereas I think those others, those very distinguished Australians I've just mentioned, they knew in a way they had to make their mark And London and New York, in Robert Hughes' case, was the place to be. I mean, that was just a reality, I think, at that time. Or so they perceived.
Before I go to this question here, tell us a bit about your background, because as I recall, your father was from the Salvation Army tradition, was he not?
Yes.
So what kind of influences did your father have and your mother have on you before you go off on your voyage?
Well, as a matter of fact, I deal with this at some length in the book because it is a memoir. Very briefly, yes, my father grew up in a Salvation Army household, but as a scholarship boy, soon broke loose from that and became a journalist for many years in the between wars period on the West Australian, and then went across to Canberra when he was recruited by Curtin to the External Affairs Department and finished up, in effect, as a diplomat in New York and so on. And, of course, he was also a historian and a writer. My mother was a writer also, a social historian. I suppose she wrote about 9 or 10 books in the course of her career. So I grew up in a household where writing was going on all the time. No one suggested that I should follow suit, but I suppose we have a bit of a tendency to emulate what parents do. So by the time I set sail for England, although by that time I had a law degree from the local university, I did have these other ambitions to be a writer, and I begin this book by tracing the dilemma in that respect as I sort of set myself up to finish some writing I was embarked upon. But I suppose the reality is that various realities descended and some of that was pushed aside. And as I say, because I was wearing two hats at all times, I didn't quite have the determination of some of those others who really were focused on and had a great love of the art forms they pursued.
Thank you for being amongst us this evening, Michael. If you were giving advice to a grandson of yours who might be 26 of age, where would you direct him in terms of the experiences you had at Oxford? Would it be at some other location?
Well, that's a tough one. As a matter of fact, I do have an 18-year-old grandson who's taken a gap year and has just been sort of rambling around Europe, and I don't quite know what he's done with his time, but he's obviously been enjoying himself. But at a slightly different level, it's very hard to say, and I feel so very much out of touch with these things. If I had a grandson who, like myself, was interested in the law, I don't think you need to go abroad to get the full range of legal experience. There are marvellous law schools in Australia these days. There's a marvellous diversity of work and ambitions to pursue. So that wouldn't apply. But just in general terms, I think the overseas experience, but so many incline more towards the American universities now, and I just really don't feel qualified quite to say which would be the better route as things stand. So that's a rather inadequate answer, but there it is.
Of the ones you mentioned early on, the Australians who went, and as Anne pointed out, who stayed in Britain, well, Germain Greer achieved much. Humphreys came home quite a bit. But tell us about Clive James, who, as you know, died recently, because he seemed to have an extraordinary depth of knowledge over an extraordinary number of subject matters. So you wouldn't, you would have been aware of his work, and particularly aware of his poetry, and you've written your own poetry. So how do you assess him as a scholar and as a poet?
Well, I met him once or twice. I can't claim to be close to him. As a scholar, I feel he has not had his full just deserts. I think he is has a very well-furnished mind, and that shows up in all his essays. His poetry, particularly the poetry in the closing years of his life, has been quite profound, but I think his reputation as a poet is still not quite determined. It's a very readable poetry, but it's probably for others to make a fuller determination. But I think at a personal level, one's now simply surmising, but that he was such a brilliant and ebullient character and so forth, that he is obviously always, just as a lawyer can be torn between practicing law and writing books, I think he always knew he had that great capacity as an entertainer and as a TV personality, which may have drawn him away from some of his more serious literary pursuits. But his body of work as an achievement is magnificent. And if I might just say, just quickly adding to that in a slightly roundabout way, one of the other names that I deal with in the book and who I know far better is the poet Peter Porter. And of course, he and Clive James were great friends, and many of you may have heard dialogues between them on the ABC and so forth. But of course, Peter Porter's position was that, unlike James, he did not go to university in Australia. And James had his degree from Sydney, went to Cambridge, and therefore was kind of equipped to move in the intellectual circles in London in a way that Peter Porter wasn't quite, and had to make a more determined effort to succeed. I say that in a roundabout way because I tell a story in the book about being with Peter at an event at the National Library in Canberra. And in the course of my talk about my much of this I'm doing tonight, I said, well, look, the truth of the matter is when I got back from Oxford, I did as is the experience of many. I seldom ever talked about it because really, you know, we know that Beazley and Turnbull and Abbott, a lot of these people have been Rhodes Scholars and have been to Oxford. They seldom talk about it because it won't win you votes in Australia. It not only won't win you votes with an electorate, it won't win you votes in the legal profession. So I made some comment in this address to that effect at the National Library that I had eschewed ever mentioning these experiences of the kind I've described tonight. Peter Porter was very cross with me. He chastened me and said, well, look, you know, I just can't understand this because in all the years I was in London, all these poets in Soho, they pretended to be bohemian and out of the loop and so forth, but most of them had degrees from Oxford. And I always felt that that was being held against me or weighed against me. So I said, well, I'm sorry, Peter, I can only speak of my own experience. My own experience in the legal profession was that it was something you never mentioned because it always brought bad vibrations with it. And I explained, that's a little personal dilemma I kind of work out in the book. I'm now so far away from it all that one can relax and talk more ethically about that sort of thing. But so coming back to your question, Gerard, there's all sorts of threads woven into the experience of these various Australian writers and artists who went abroad, and what they say in their memoirs may often be affected by personal circumstances.
Janet.
Speaking to the mic. Thank you very much. It's been absolutely fascinating. I believe you will mention in the book Field Marshal Slim. I wondered if you'd talk about him tonight.
Yes, I...
Especially you might background Field Marshal Slim.
Yes. Well, of course, Field Marshal Slim was a professional soldier, and he fought at Gallipoli and in other fields of action in the First World War, but I suppose he's principally notable as a soldier that in the Second World War, when the British had been forced out of Burma and India was threatened, that Slim reconstituted the armed force and moved back into Burma, gradually defeated the Japanese, and Churchill, in his war history, speaks of him very highly in that regard. And then in the post-war era, Field Marshal Slim became Governor General of Australia in the 1950s. At that time, my father in the Menzies government was part of Minister for Territories, and quite often Slim would come up there or come to the Northern Territory for events. So they got to know each other. So the point I make is that when I arrived in London, at that time my father was Minister for External Affairs, coming and going from London and New York and that sort of thing. And on one occasion, as I describe at some length in the book, we drove down to Windsor Castle together and had lunch with Field Marshal Slim, who by that time was Warden of Windsor Castle, Her Majesty's representative in that field. And we had a wonderful lunch, and all sorts of war stories were told, and that was my one close exposure to Field Marshal Slim, and it obviously left a lasting impression on me. And of course one then reads further into the career, and the picture is fleshed out.
Yes. Just before I get to Michael, you're a lawyer, You're in London in the 60s at the Profumo Affair. You sat on the Supreme Court when you got back to Australia after some years. Dr. Ward at the Profumo Affair, guilty or not guilty? And you might background that too.
Yes, all right, I'll background it quickly. I suppose before I lose, I think Ward was treated unjustly. And I pause to say that Geoffrey Robertson has written a book called Stephen Ward Was Innocent, in which he gets into the legal technicalities of the thing. But trying to put it in broad overview, you may recall that John Profumo was Minister for War. As a result of being mixing with Lord Astor at Cliveden, where Astor's osteopath Stephen Ward had a small cottage, Profumo and others, including the Russian naval attaché Ivanov, both commenced to have a sexual affair with Christine Keeler, one of the sort of showgirls at the time in the Soho scene, and also with Mandy Rice Davies. Well, that eventually the security people got wind of this and warned off Profumo, who immediately dropped the situation, and that's where it remained for a year or so, until Keeler began to have some rather tempestuous altercations in public places with some West Indian lovers. And of course the tabloid press got into all this and began to probe as to who exactly was this girl and what was her background. And gradually the press became possessed of the knowledge that Profumo probably had this affair at the same time as the Russian naval attaché. So there was a security issue of sorts. It was against that background, in a wrong-headed moment, that under pressure from his party, Profumo lied to Parliament and said there'd been no affair with Christine Keeler, but he eventually had to renounce that and thus resigned, and that effectively is the Profumo scandal. But in the meantime, Ward had been prosecuted for living off the immoral earnings of prostitutes, namely Keeler and Mandy Rice Davies. And that trial was running on as Lord Denning was briefed by the government to prepare a report on the whole thing. I built up the Denning report a moment ago. Well, Ward's trial came to a rather tragic end because Ward could see that the whole case was rather stacked against him and in the way the judge was presiding. And he took an overdose of barbiturates at about the time the jury was going out for their verdict. He lay in a coma for several days and then expired. By that time, the jury had brought in a verdict of guilty. So that was really an overview of the whole Profumo affair, but Ward was seen to be at the centre of it as the man who had been introducing all these people to the contacts that led to their downfall. And many journalists felt at the time that he was being set up as the scapegoat. He was the one that the government was angling to say, well, look, you know, Profumo's made a few misjudgments, but the real villain in the piece is Ward. So a bit like we have seen in Australia with various legal cases, the sense of moral outrage has gradually fed its way into the legal system in the way the prosecutors proceed and judges give directions and so on. So Robertson's book on the purely technical legal points says, well, look, really, these two girls weren't prostitutes. They were just good time showgirls who did a few cabaret acts and so forth. So it can't be said that Ward was living off their earnings, and he was a fairly well-heeled osteopath in any event. He was really wrongly charged and wrongly convicted, is Robertson's case. And Robertson says, secondly, in any event, there was such a groundswell of moral outrage against this man with some peculiar sexual proclivities and so on that fed into the sort of directions that the judge gave and that underpinned the prosecution case. So that's it more or less in a nutshell, and I tend to be persuaded by what Geoffrey Robertson was out there.
I think it's the final question. Jacqueline.
Can I ask you about another trial at that time? I think it was around that time of the Oz trials with some famous Australians. Were you there during that period, and do you have knowledge of that?
I have knowledge of it simply by what I've read. I had left by that time. Richard Neville and the other editors of Oz had published the allegedly pornographic magazine, and that was brought to trial, and I think Geoffrey Robertson was junior counsel to John Mortimer of great fame, So I can't really throw any particular light on it, except it sort of perhaps feeds back into something I was saying a little earlier, that I think to the mid-60s and earlier 60s, you not only had the sort of upheavals in Paris with the rioting students and so on, you had this kind of groundswell in the press of various moral issues. They could see how they could bring down governments. Macmillan forced to resign because of the supposed lack of action on the Profumo affair. So, and then of course the Oz trial was just another example, and Private Eye, the magazine, all those things were happening. It was just that general feeding of a certain mood of change or instability characterised it.
I think we have time for one down the back there.
Thank you. When I lived in London...
Speak up a bit.
Sorry, you hear me?
Speak up.
When I lived in London in the last 3 years of the 60s, there was a feeling that many of the Brits had moral superiority, a feeling of moral superiority compared with the Australians. And I think that prevented many people from staying for a very long time, because they saw that it was going to be very difficult to get ahead, that there was an old boy network in place, and parents pulled strings for their children, and that wasn't available to many Australians, despite having a good degree.
Okay, so the question is...
So I have a question that follows that.
Got to be quick.
So I think that once Britain opened up to Brexit, and many more people from other countries came in, the British accepted them much more readily, and Britain has opened up. I've had much more contact with it in recent years. My sister lived there for many years.
Okay, we've got to...
Do you think the exit from the EU is going to affect the British mindset?
Okay, if I could summarise, the question is, in the late 60s, were the British up themselves? And has it changed since Brexit? What?
Will
it change? But you've got to be brief.
Well, I think it will change. As to a sense of British superiority, I must say I didn't experience that myself. I married into an English family, and one got to know that whole family circle very well, and everything worked very comfortably. I mean, I don't think there was a sense of people being put down or anything of that kind. And in the university context, the teachers were quite dedicated, so they're in the business of conveying knowledge, not to make points. I'm led to believe by other writings that all the sorts of things that you say probably were around, but I didn't experience that much myself. So.
Thank you, Nicholas. Just step aside. So our speaker ends up telling us that, in Barry Humphrey's words, you married a pommy sheila, huh? Was the term at the time. Look, many thanks to Nicholas Hasluck for Beyond the Equator, an Australian memoir, and talking about his experiences in Britain in the 60s and elsewhere over the equator later on. And I'm sure our author is happy to sign books tonight. But for now, congratulations, well done. It's a great tale, and I'm sure it's going to be very successful. So well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.